Podcast, by the way, am I
it's not my podcast, it's, do you know John Donis? I'm recording now, by the way, I'm just going to let you go. Yeah, it's John Donis, the Badcast.
Okay.
It's only on number three, just on number three.
I haven't heard it, so...
Okay, it's one of these, there's many sceptical podcasts that are coming out around the place, and he's one of them, but John's been on the scene for quite a while. And
am I allowed to swear, is what I want to know.
No. He can bleep if he needs to, can't he? Okay. John's going editing.
He can edit. You can edit, can't you, John?
There you go. Okay, so...
He said yes, I heard him.
Ghosts. They're a pain in the arse. Trust me, I'm a ghost hunter. I know. Only, actually, that's probably the main problem. This whole idea that people who label themselves as paranormal researchers somehow hold the answers and know what they're talking about because 9 times out of 10 what they say sounds scientific, even when it isn't. If anything, you shouldn't trust me, because I'm a ghost hunter. And ghost hunting is a tangled web of nonsense and misinformation and generally confused people walking around in the dark, talking to themselves whilst their faces are cast in a green hue that makes their eyes look like something out of Riddick. Allow me to explain my frustration. In 2005, I formed a paranormal research team that is now known as Wiltshire Phenomena Research because I didn't trust what I was seeing on TV and I wanted to work things out for myself. Was there really an afterlife? Were there really such things as ghosts and demons and elementals and poltergeists? However, to begin with, instead of actually answering any of the questions I'd originally set out to answer, I actually just added to them. I became friends with people who I thought knew what they were talking about because they'd been researching ghosts for longer. They said things that sounded scientific, they threw a few quantums into the equation here and there, and they had an air of superiority about them that made the 18-year-old me think that I could trust them as a source of information. I began to do things like table tipping, seances, glass divination and dowsing, trigger object experiments and scrying, pretty much anything to try and contact a ghost. Despite actually having set out to try and work out if there actually were such things as ghosts. Somehow, I'd made the logical leap that because these people who made themselves seem knowledgeable said there were, it was a fact. And because a glass we all had our fingers on was moving around a table, that fact was reinforced. Because of this, we all jumped into trying to contact said ghosts without actually realising just how close-minded we were being. I look back now at the countless hours I spent in dark rooms and strange buildings with my finger on an upturned glass, pleading with ghosts to move it as proof that they were there. Quite often, you're able to hear the nightlife around you, the sound gently ebbing in from the streets outside as other people went about their social lives, whilst I sat inside, waving mine goodbye. It makes me want to cry. Now, as somebody who is quite vocally sceptical, I often get asked how it is that I could have been so close-minded about the things that I was doing, and after a lot of thinking, I long ago came to the conclusion that it was because I didn't know the difference between being open-minded and being close-minded. I didn't know what scepticism actually was. See, I held beliefs in ghosts, I did weird stuff, and I was willing to try anything to prove that ghosts existed, even if science said it didn't work, because I knew, or at least I thought I did, that some things had to be seen or experienced to be believed. I was often told by my paranormal peers of the time that science didn't hold all the answers. And although I know that's true in the sense that science is an ongoing process of continuous evaluation and testing of hypotheses, at the time that I was a woo, I took it to mean that science was close-minded because science didn't understand what we are experiencing and so was dismissive of it. Now I look back and I can see that I had it the wrong way round, because it was me that was dismissive of what science showed about the things I was doing. Why? Well, because the facts, such as involuntary muscular movement can cause dowels and rods to move, and that orbs are actually just circles of confusion caused by artifacts in front of the lens of a camera as the flash goes off, didn't fit into my belief system, and so I dismissed them because it suited me. I was a scary, silly woo, and I'm not embarrassed to admit that because at least now I can see how easy it is to be misled. I don't so much as look down upon and mock people who still hold the beliefs I used to. Instead, I'm able to understand why they do, and how critical thinking needs to be promoted. The problem is, though, that people are inspired by what they see on television because it makes ghost research look easy, like something anyone can do by picking up a night vision camcorder and setting off to the nearest supposed haunted hotspot to get scared silly with their friends. Most people involved in paranormal research have a similar tale to mine. They were bored and untrusting of what they saw on television, and so they wanted to find things out for themselves. However, although they'll tell you this story, when you actually read their reports or watch what they do, they're actually just replicating exactly what it is that they see on television. And this is exactly what I was doing. But when I had it pointed out to me that I was being closed-minded by none other than John Donis, he who oversees the world of badpsychics.com, it made me stop and assess what I was doing. And suddenly, I felt rather silly. I call it my awakening. It's when I stopped contradicting myself. And bad things happened because of my new sceptical approach. I received threats, people stopped talking to me, and people called me names, my favourite being the Tracy Beaker of the paranormal world, because apparently I was a silly, stroppy teenager throwing her toys out of the pram, just like the fictional Tracy Beaker from the Jacqueline Wilson books. However, a lot of people who call themselves paranormal researchers can't see the errors of their own ways, like I did. They've been researching for decades and still use techniques that don't have any effect. You have to wonder why. What is it that makes them hold on to their beliefs that certain things work when they clearly don't? An example would be one of the most common tools of a ghost hunter, the EMF meter. Something promoted by the show Ghost Hunters is being able to pick up on ghostly presences because Grant, Jason and their crew promote the idea that high electromagnetic fields cause people to feel haunted. This isn't a fact at all. Research is still being conducted into whether this is true or not, and studies into this idea are often conflicted in their findings. Which is why my team, WPR, don't use EMF meters at all, because we can't be 100% sure that there's any point. Yet, a look around many paranormal teams will show you that a lot of the teams do. Why? Another favourite tool is the dictaphone, again promoted by the show Ghost Hunters, as being able to record ghostly voices that you don't hear at the time, or electronic voice phenomena as many people refer to them. This is an area of ghost research that has been largely debunked because of the amount of rational explanations available for what is recorded. Yet, many teams present EVP recordings as evidence. Why? Then, of course, there are the more spiritual techniques, such as those shown on shows like Most Haunted or Ghost Adventures, like the Ouija board or table tipping, dowsing, mediumship, and seances and other such nonsense that is all down to human involvement and confirmation bias. But how many paranormal research teams still employ these methods of investigation despite the level of evidence that shows just how these techniques actually work? Why? Let's take another example. A locally produced television show that aired on ITV called The Paranormal Five promoted the idea that trigger object experiments were some sort of proof of paranormal forces. A location they visited would often find piles of small stones or pebbles that hadn't been there before. So the show's investigators set up items and either drew around them or covered them in talcum powder. But if you step back and think about it, so what if the object you've drawn around moves? What does it prove? Nothing. Unless, of course, in your head, it proves that you are right to believe in ghosts. And this is exactly where the problem lies. People may be sceptical of paranormal television shows, yet they don't spread their scepticism far enough so that it covers all the ideas that these television shows promote. This has to be either because they're too lazy to conduct their own research, or because holding on to debunked ideas as worthwhile suits them because those ideas, in their minds, back up what they hold to be true. It's incredibly frustrating and it's a shame because it's not actually all that terrible to not have a conclusion about what you're researching. If anything, it helps you to remain open-minded, which can only be a good thing. The information is out there for anybody who wants to research ghosts and hauntings and alleged paranormal activity from an unbiased point of view. You can visit sites such as asap.org or the Centre of Inquiry site at csicop.org. or even my humble site at wiltshirephenomena.com to find out exactly what causes certain techniques such as table tipping or EMF meters to work. This has been Hayley Stevens for the Badcast.
Hello, I'm William Broom, and some of you will know me on the BP Forum as Kensington. How are you going? And welcome to Sydney, Australia. Okay then, hands up, how many of you have seen psychics or thought about going to see, say, a psychic or a medium? I see a few hands there. That doesn't surprise me. I've got a confession to make. Some of you may already know it, but I myself have seen quite a few psychics and mediums in my time. And I've had quite a few interesting experiences with them and stories to tell, which has all led to my journey towards scepticism and truth and critical thinking. But I thought off the top of my head, I'd give you some advice about seeing a psychic. Of course, some people will say don't go and see them, but I think it's your money. If you wish to see them, go and see them, as long as you know what you're getting yourself into, and you can keep an open mind with that. So if you're going to see a psychic, ask yourself why you're going to see one. Is it because you're nosy? Is it because you really want to know about the future? Is it because you're worried about the future? Is it because you want to speak to a loved one who may have died? Are you having issues with your relationship or work, etc.? As long as you know why you're going, that's a good place to start. Of course, how do you find a psychic? Well, you might see them in the back of a newspaper, in a magazine, on a website, on a television channel. And it's up to you what you actually do with the psychics and whether you go and see one or not. But if you do see one, at least try and understand the techniques that many psychics and mediums use, such as hot reading, whereby they do research on you to begin with before you actually go and see them, or cold reading, whereby they might be able to tell things from how you look, your age, your clothing, etc. So know about hot and cold reading, and know about some of what they may be doing may be pure guesswork. And these are all interesting things to look into. So once you've contacted a psychic, and you know why you're going to see them, and you know the tricks of the trade, when you speak to them on the phone, just be aware that when you give them your full name, they may do a Google search on you. They may use other internet searches or other means, in other words, hot reading, to find out a bit of information about you and your life and those involved in your life and events that are happening. So be aware that that could be taking place. And then when you get to the reading, think about what you're actually telling them when you get in the room. You know, when you're doing the small talk, the greetings, etc., saying, oh, I ran late, I had to have lunch with my husband or whatever. You've immediately told the so-called medium and psychic that you've got a husband. Oh, I've got a cold at the moment. You've told them that you're not in the best of health. Just be aware, and also be aware of their questions. Are they leading? Are your own questions leading somewhere? So if somebody says, have you got a cousin or do you know somebody in your life called John? And you think, you mean Jackie or Jason? And they go, yeah, that's what I meant. You might see that as a hit. Now, here's something you've really got to do if you can. It may not be possible, but if you can, and I can't urge you enough, please, please, please record your readings. This is absolutely vital. Some psychics and mediums will offer this as a service included in the cost or at an extra cost. If it's an extra cost, I recommend that you pay it. Also, if it's a phone psychic reading, if you can record it, in some countries there are legal practicalities with recording phone conversations, etc. But if you can, always make sure that you record your readings. Now, you may think, why? Well, not only will you want to go back through it to hear what they said, you know, we can only remember so much that we're told in any one sitting, but what you may remember of the reading may not actually be what happened. I've seen a few psychics, and a couple of them I've had recorded, and my memory of events were not what was actually recorded. You know, how we remember things can be rather different from what actually happened. So do record it. Also, by listening, you may actually hear if perhaps something they refer to later is something you actually mentioned earlier. So you might think it's fresh, but actually, had you mentioned it perhaps in your earlier on in the reading and they remembered it and brought it up a bit later? All these things are worth thinking about because they are vital to the reading and knowing if it's genuine or not. So always make sure you get it recorded and try and listen to the techniques, learn about what they're saying, learn about how they do it. For many psychics and mediums, and I'm not going to tell you they're all fake, I'll let you work that one out for yourself, whether you believe it or not. But many of them, as I say, use techniques such as guesswork, cold reading, hot reading. And have a listen and see if once you understand those techniques, if you can hear them in the reading, because if you can, that will give an indication perhaps they are using a few of those techniques. So do have a listen. Always record your readings. Be careful what you tell the mediums or psychics before the readings. And always, always go in with an open mind and don't tell them too much. In fact, tell them very, very little. You are paying them to give you a service. You are not paying them to get information out of you. You are paying them to give you information that you need, okay? But I can't urge you enough or encourage you enough to please, please, please record your readings. I'm William Broome, Kensington, here in Sydney, Australia, for the Badcast for BP. Talk to you soon.
Hello, this is Karen Stolzner from the Point of Inquiry and Monster Talk podcasts. I'm here to tell you about the Frank's Box, a groundbreaking machine invented by Thomas Edison that can predict the future, diagnose and cure disease, exorcise demons, contact aliens, angels and spirits, and communicate with your deceased loved ones. Well, sorry to get your hopes up. It's really just a broken radio. Inspired by an article about electronic voice phenomena in the now-defunct Popular Electronics magazine, a gentleman by the name of Frank Sumption built a ghost box, which he now egotistically calls the Frank's Box. But the credit can't all go to the article. Frank was also assisted by a team of spirits in the creation of his device. According to Frank, these spirits call him their Purple Princess. He says, and I quote, "They claim I'm their long-lost purple princess, kidnapped from my home planet long ago when Earth had spaceflight by the ancient Egyptians. I couldn't be rescued at that time, so I was transported forward in time, to now, at the end of the current Earth cycle when I could go home. It gets weird from there. Other entities that talk through the box claim they see a woman where I should be." End quote. Hey, I don't write this stuff, I just report it. Anyway, Frank's box is a busted radio, as the scan lock is disabled on this homemade receiver. Listening to it is kind of like twisting the knob on a radio very quickly and hearing bits of radio stations through the white noise. And like a comic book story, in breaking the radio, Frank thinks it develops superpowers. Even though he can't tune into a channel, he thinks it can channel spirits. He believes his device is some sort of radio for spirit DJs, and he claims that spirits and various other entities remodulate the white noise, that is, they speak through the white noise, using the fragments of radio as their voices. During a visit to Frank's hometown in Colorado, I recently met with the Frank's Box creator himself, accompanied by Matthew Baxter of the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Research Society. Matthew and I arrived at the appointed place, a truck stop restaurant in Littleton. And there was Frank Sumption. But how could we tell it was him? Well, the Purple Princess was wearing purple, a purple striped shirt and a purple earring. He was there with his wife, and the four of us proceeded to have a really strange chat over a slice of pie. Frank told us that his Frank's Box provides proof of an afterlife. However, he argues that the device isn't paranormal because, to him, paranormal refers to black magic and witchcraft. He explained that his device, and I quote, "functions on the quantum level." "What do you mean by quantum?" I asked him. Frank shrugged his shoulders and admitted, "I don't know." Then he told us he doesn't always need the box to hear the voices. He said that he could also hear voices through running water and that his wife sends him messages telepathically. He's in contact with a number of spirits whom he calls the guys, and these are mostly women with German names, except for a loyal spirit named Otto. Okay, so he's sounding kinda insane. But Frank has thousands of fans, and his Frank's Box has a cult following. In fact, there are many knockoffs of the Frank's Box. There's Joe's Box, the Spirit Box, and some of these are commercially made, such as the Mini Box, which is made by Paranormal Systems. There's also Christopher Moon's Telephone to the Dead, which is merely a Frank's Box he borrowed from Frank and gave a facelift. Frank loaned one to us too, but we don't charge hundreds of dollars for a reading with the box like Moon does, and hundreds more if you want him to translate the messages. But the results from the Frank's box aren't messages. These are random fragments of radio noise, including bits of music and speech, but this isn't language. Here are some sample messages listed on the Purple Alien Girl, which is Frank's website. Purple, good morning. Princess, you can't smoke. It's time for testing. Satisfy the scientists. But this supposed evidence doesn't satisfy the scientists. Engineer Paul Turner examined our Frank's box and he observed, I speculate that the builder has a rudimentary knowledge of electronics, perhaps at a ham radio level or late 1970s trade school. So, if the entities indeed gave him the knowledge to build the device as he states in his schematics, apparently they didn't keep up with the technical journals. You've probably already guessed the phenomenon at work behind the Frank's box. Yes, our old friend pareidolia. Hearing messages from the Frank's box is audio pareidolia, the auditory equivalent of seeing Jesus on a tortilla. This is also like backmasking, thinking that Sergeant Pepper's played backwards reveals hidden messages, or David Oates' theory of reverse speech, that our latent desires and fears are somehow revealed in speech played backwards. But this is the mind searching for meaning. In the end, the Frank's box is just a really crappy radio. And no, Thomas Edison didn't invent this machine, or any other form of spirit communication. Just ask the staff at the Thomas Edison National Historic Site. This is Karen Stolznow for the Bad Psychics podcast.
This is John Donis for the Badcast. In recent times, Joe Power has attracted quite a lot of media attention. In fact, we have covered the last few years of his professional career in some detail on the site. But just how has a psychic such as him manipulated his position in life in his attempts to become a celebrity psychic? To find out, we must go back in time. In April 2006, Joe Power caused controversy when he announced that he was going to contact the spirit of John Lennon. As you can imagine, this caused a lot of discussion. Even Yoko Ono had her representatives release a statement calling the stunt exploitative. But of course, media attention is exactly what Joe Power was after. A US television station had apparently found someone who would be willing to partake in this stunt for a pay-per-view TV special. Oh, how very spiritual. And at a price of only $9.95. That's a good $5 cheaper than the Princess Diana seance was a few years earlier. So what did John Lennon have to say for himself? Well, the groundbreaking message from the dead Lennon was, peace, the message is peace. Now if that isn't worth $9.95, then I don't know what is. Despite appearing on this American special, things were still not going great for Joe. At odds with his own claims, he had to cancel shows on a regular basis due to poor ticket sales. And when you can't sell out small hotel function rooms, you know that a new stunt is in order. One of the claims Joe has made over the years is that he could help the police solve crimes. He claimed to have helped Southport police in the Lindsay Kay murder case. Yet when we asked Detective Superintendent Jeff Sloan, he made the following statement. I wish to state categorically that as senior investigating officer on the Lindsay Quay murder, I made a policy decision not to use psychics on the investigation. Joe Power has allegedly made claims that he assisted the inquiry, but this is not the case. Joe also claimed, through one of his astonishing spirit links, to have known the killer of model Sally Ann Bowman, and that he informed the police that the killer was a Stephen or Stevan White, aged between 24 and 26, and was a delivery driver. Yet following DNA evidence, the police arrested and charged 36-year-old chef Mark Dixie, who is now serving a life sentence in prison. So yet again, Joe was wrong, despite telling people that he helped the police. After cancelling 44% of his publicised shows in 2005, 2006 and 2007, Joe Power was still hungry for fame. In 2008, he made an astounding public statement when he said, TV mediums are ripping people off. The place is saturated with fake mediums getting away with playing on people's emotions. Throughout 2008, things just got worse for Joe. Of 65 advertised shows, at least 51 were cancelled due to poor sales. But in 2009, Joe saw another opportunity to get himself more media coverage. At the time, when the Madeleine McCann story was worldwide news, a child by the name of Shannon Matthews went missing. Joe visited Shannon's mother, Karen Matthews, and her partner, Craig Meehan, and gave them a reading which was quoted in the Sunday People newspaper, alongside a photograph of Joe standing next to Karen Matthews. Unfortunately, despite claiming to be clairvoyant, clairaudient and clairsentient, and despite spending a lot of time with the family of Shannon Matthews, Joe seemed to have missed one tiny detail, that Karen Matthews had actually been behind the fake kidnap of her own 9-year-old daughter. Karen Matthews is now serving time in prison and has shown no remorse for her crimes. The one time that Joe truly put himself on the line, he failed miserably. So now we are up to date on Power's story. Many tacky stunts, failed tours, cancelled shows, yet still he managed to find himself a book publisher. When a member of Bad Psychics went along to one of his signings, all that could be found was the lonely figure of Joe sat at a table on his own. No line of people or crowds scrambling for his photo, nobody asking for an autograph. Maybe this is all that is left of this man, or maybe he has already planned his next stunt. Only time will tell. But Joe would have one last dig at those who dare to doubt him. I'd like to quote from my good friend, Bad Psychics member and Merseyside skeptic Marsh, who recently met Joe Power and handed him an application form for the JREF $1 million challenge. This is how Joe responded. "The thing about you skeptics is that you sit there festering in front of your computers at 3 a.m. thinking of ways to get at people. What if I were to sit in front of your house and tell people you're paedophiles? I think most skeptics probably are paedophiles. I mean, you sat around at 3 a.m. plotting, aren't you? Do you deny that?" Joe Power's career should serve as a warning to any wannabe celebrity psychics out there. Don't make claims you can't back up, because one annoying thing about skeptics is that we investigate, we search, and we find out the truth. I would just like to say a special thank you to forum member Lester, who without his hard work, this monologue wouldn't be possible. Thank you, Lester. My name is John Donis. Thank you and goodbye.
You have been listening to The Badcast. Check out the website at www.badcast.co.uk.
Play it back.